The White Network presents Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. Your host, Carolyn Yeager.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm so glad you have joined me to hear about today's very special and timely topic, Allied war crimes that were carried out specifically in February 1945. Of course, it is denied that they are war crimes by the keepers and apologists of the victors' history, and that is one reason the victors insisted, beginning in January 1943 already, on a total unconditional victory over the Axis powers, just so that they could dictate history. I'm talking specifically about the war crime of the torpedoing by Soviet submarines of the German rescue ships, the Wilhelm Gustloff, on January 30th, the General Steuben on February 10th, which the 69th anniversary of this, of the Steuben sinking, is 2 days from now on Monday, and the Goya on April 16th, still 2 months from now. Latest research, that one is not in February, of course, but we will mention it just as part of the trio. The February one, of course, is the General Steuben, which we'll be talking about more. And the latest research shows that over 20,000 living souls who were only trying to flee coming under occupation by the merciless Red Army died in those three sinkings in the icy cold waters of the Baltic Sea. Much better known is the war crime of the bombing of Dresden on February 13th, 14th, when a minimum of 150,000 civilians were murdered in the most horrible and horrifying way. To talk about this and also the overall bombing of German cities and towns from 1942 to 1945 is a distinguished scholar who I am pleased to call a friend, Dr. Andreas Wesserle, who will be calling the program from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Andreas Wesserle is one of the most interesting men I know. I met him a few years ago, and he was actually on the Heretics Hour 6 times when it was at the Voice of Reason, and his last appearance was February 21st, 2011. He was on the program in 2010 and 2011, and then I lost track of him somehow. We were emailing somewhat, but somehow that got, and then I didn't hear from him. I didn't get a response from him a couple of times, and so I thought, well, okay. But we got back in touch with each other about a month ago or so, and now we've arranged for him to come on today's program. He's a great scholar. He's so interesting. I've learned so much from him, and I know you're going to learn a lot today. He's also written a letter to Queen Elizabeth II about the monument in London for Bomber Command monument, and then he's talked about a few other things, and then he has another part to it. I don't know if that's part of the letter. About some very, very interesting information of the, how the bombing, strategic bombing, how and why the Britain developed the kind of strategic bombing capacity it did, and also the United States did that too. So it's like, and then why no one else was able to do it. Well, here he is, so let me get my Skype page up and answer his call. There he is. You should say hello in a minute. Good afternoon to you, Dr. Vesterle. It is so good to hear your voice. And as usual, you're very punctual. And you are, of course, what's that word I'm trying to think of? Like all Germans, you are conscientious about carrying out what you promised to do.
I'm trying to, yes.
Right. Well, I was just telling the folks about you and reminding them how you had been on the program before. And I've got that written in the mailer, but I've just got to the part where I was going to say that you're quite the scholar, particularly in certain areas. Oh, I know, I was talking about your letter to Queen Elizabeth, and then the second part of it where you describe the bombing, the strategic bombing, system that the British developed and the Americans and why and all of that. I went over that before today's program. I had read all this, but I think I was trying to read too much at one time, and I kind of didn't take the last part in very well. And, boy, I really found it extremely interesting, and I want to be sure that we can talk about that.
Yeah.
Certainly by the second hour, we'll devote to your what you've written here, unless we even get started with it earlier. But I've already described about the sinking of the General Steuben and the Dresden bombing and so on that we're going to cover first because it's timely, and particularly the February 1, which is February 10th, on Monday, the anniversary of this sinking of the General Steuben, which is the third worst of those three sinkings, which are which hold dubious distinction of being the three worst maritime disasters in world history, in naval history. And they all took place in that little period of time. First, if you would like to give a little information about yourself to kind of orient the listeners to who you are. I didn't quite get into that part, you know, just that you were born in Prague, and then what?
That's right. My parents come from what was, at the time of their birth, the Kingdom of Hungary. Now it's called Slovakia. There were quite a few Germans living in various regions, and one of those regions was Holland. And my parents' hometown is Deutschbomer in Hungarian name, Eprona. And those towns are about 700, 800 years old, and now they're 900 years old. Many of them were founded around the 12th and 13th centuries and 14th centuries. So that's quite a path to have.
Mm-hmm.
Then my father studied in Prague at the German University, and he got a job in Prague as a chemical engineer, and then made his way upward. Then in 1945, on Palm Sunday of 1945, there was a large raid by the American 8th Air Force from Italy, and they destroyed all the heavy industry on the east end of Prague. And my father's factory received 7 direct hits by the bombs. It was quite a sight. The huge concrete and steel beams were strewn about the street just like matchboxes or matches and toothpicks. Matter of fact, just like toothpicks.
Hmm.
And then my aunt, who had fled from my parents' hometown of Deutschbrom and were staying with us in our apartment in Prague, insisted that we leave which was a good idea. So we all, and my father got a small truck from some check acquaintances, and then we all piled into there with a few belongings, and we went to the to the Sudetenland outside of Bavaria in the Bohemian Forest. And we were there for about 6 weeks or so. And then in June, we went across the border between Bohemia and Bavaria. I went on the Bavaria side. I went to a village which is overrun with expellees and refugees. The village itself originally had a population of about 4,000, but there were 20,000 expellees and refugees from East Germany and Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Romania, and so on. So it was very chaotic, and there was nothing to eat. And then in 2 months, my father was lucky enough to get a job as a...
You know, Dr. Westerlund, yeah. I don't want you to lose your voice by going through all this in too much detail, because it is on one of the programs that you did. Right. And I would like, and I want to be sure people can hear you. I've got my, I'm trying to stay about the same level you are at, which means I should not talk so loud, and so that people can adjust their volume. Can you be sure, I know it's hard to be loud enough on the telephone, but can you be sure, are you talking as close into the mouthpiece as possible?
Well, I'm trying to, yeah.
Yeah, that sounds better.
Great.
Okay, and I know it's hard for us. I want you to do a lot of talking, so I don't want you to wear out your voice. So I will link people to your story, to that story where we went through it in detail on the program page, and at least they got the idea of what you went through, you know, when you were young and the kind of conditions. And then, of course, as you were going to say, you stayed in Bavaria for a couple of years, didn't you?
For 7 years.
Seven.
In 1952, we emigrated to Chicago, to the United States.
Yes, right. And then you, you know, you were still in school, and you went on to college and university, and
right.
You got a lot of degrees, and you have had a long profession in teaching, in both in the United States and in Europe.
Right.
And that is, and today, you are still actively working, and, you have written this great thing here that you, and we're going to talk about that in a few minutes, but let's cover the ship sinkings. And, you know, I went through it, but what can you add to these, to what was going on when these, and my question that I wanted to really consider here for the listeners was, Were these war crimes? I've read that it has been concluded that they were not war crimes, you know, that they had, they were legitimate targets. Would you give your opinion on that?
Well, that's somewhat controversial, but one thing is for sure, that the vast majority of people on those ships were civilians, mostly women and children and old people. And there probably were a few soldiers among them, but they were not warships for sure. And so it would have been, from the viewpoint of international law, it would have been a lot more advisable for the Russians not to torpedo those ships, you know.
Well, I certainly agree, and I think most people would agree. Now, let's look at the statistics here. The General Steuben, and it's, I believe that they got rid of the word general, but then I keep seeing it written that way, so I'm going to say it that way. It was actually a
because
hospital.
Washington, you know, promoted Steuben to be a general.
That's right. And so, but I saw that the United States has a ship named Steuben, or they did also. USS Steuben. Or it was maybe USS General Steuben. So they named their ship, they named a ship after him because he was served in the American Revolutionary War.
Right. He was one of the leading soldiers involved.
Right. Very important. And so maybe that's why then the German government eventually decided to drop the name General on their ship, because they were in such a terrible war with the United States by then. And so that might be what happened. But anyway, it is the Steuben was only the third worst of these three sinkings. It was on, as I say, February 10th. And on board, this is the latest that they have to say about it. I think I've got that here. Where am I looking? I'm going to go down here. Oh, I think I've got that repeated up here. I'm screwing around again. Okay, yeah. This is the latest. On board were, it was a hospital ship. This one was carrying wounded soldiers, 2,800 wounded German soldiers, and only 800 civilians on this ship. And 100, they did have 100 returning soldiers. That's only 100 compared to the almost 3,000 wounded soldiers. Of course,
right.
I guess they didn't want them to be treated and get back in the battle or something, but that might be the justification for this ship. There were 270 medical personnel and 12 nurses from Pillau, and then if the ship's crew and so on. So I would call this a hospital ship carrying wounded soldiers and this Soviet submarine, the same one that had already sunk the Wilhelm Gustloff in January 30th. Now, this is only, what, a couple weeks later, or less, actually 11 or 12 days later. He went after this one, too, and this was the submarine S-13 with that guy. Do I have his information here? I must have it somewhere. I don't know. What did I do? It's on that on his page. I wrote about it somewhere, and then I didn't put it on this page. Looks like, but he had quite a looking into his history. He was a rather irresponsible kind of a guy, but he was a good submarine captain. I mean, he was good at it, and he really hunted these ships down. He spent quite a few hours getting just in the right location and finding, where to hit them, where it would be the final blow.
Yeah.
And he did that in this two torpedoes, and it took only 20 minutes for this ship to sink, and only 300 people were saved, only 300 survivors, and this was a total of. Where did I put those totals? This was a total of, 5,000 analysis on this was, in the Steuben was carrying 5,200 people, and 4,500 of them perished. This is the latest research on it. So the numbers in this case have gone up on these ships, whereas other things they keep trying to take them down. But people have done more research. And what they were doing in the beginning was they had the passenger list, going by the passenger list. But then it was they finally accepted that there are a lot of people that got crowded on there who weren't on the passenger list.
Exactly.
Yeah. So there was more of them, and they've done all kinds of sophisticated study of these things. And one of them was in the National Geographic magazine, and there are lots of ways that they determined did discovery channel, internet channel, no, television channel also did a series and had a bunch of experts working on it, and they raised the numbers up for these three. But so, somewhere I read that if a ship had to have a big red cross on it in order to be considered, where it couldn't be bombed, but I doubt this ship did, but they were also trying to, I don't think they trusted that anyway. And it wasn't probably authorized by the Red Cross at this ship. And they were just using what they had to try to get these refugees out of the zone there.
Right.
And they were traveling at night. So that shows they were hoping not to be seen, right? Somewhere I read about how this one had a, they thought there was, traitors who had given away the location of the ships.
Yeah.
Have you heard about that?
Well, I heard that these ships, actually some of them, were actually quite speedy. And if they developed full steam ahead, they would have escaped the submarine. I don't know why they did not. But the conditions were so chaotic, you know, mm-hmm. with hundreds of thousands of refugees crowding on the shore and all that, and with the Soviets pushing in with their military, it was extremely difficult to keep any kind of order.
Well, did these ship captains know that there was a submarine in the vicinity? I think part of what this that I read, boy, I didn't do a very good job of getting all this stuff back up here again, was that the reports, that's where the sabotage came in, that the reports that there were some submarines, the submarine was spotted, was not passed on to the captain or the crew of the ship.
Possibly.
In one of these
yeah,
cases.
Possibly.
Yeah. And this...
Carolyn, could I interrupt you for a second?
Sure.
Was this article that appeared in the National Geographic, was it offered by the famous explorer, the maritime explorer from New York? I've forgotten his name.
It says at the bottom, this is just a little summing up of the numbers. It says at the bottom, David Woodell.
I don't believe that's the name. Because about 8 or 9 years ago, or 10 years ago, there was a brief TV program with a couple of the survivors of these ships. Mm-hmm. And this well-known maritime explorer from New York who also looked up the wreck of the Bismarck in the Atlantic near Ireland. He went down, or anyway, his camera went down and photographed the Bismarck at the bottom of the sea. And he also carried out various other explorations. I forgot whether he was involved with the Titanic or not. But anyway, then he and a few of the survivors went back to the site of the sinkings in the Baltic Sea, and they dropped some wreaths, you know, in memory of the many thousands of dead. And it was broadcast on TV a long time ago, whenever it was, 9 or 10 years ago, something like that. But just once. It was never repeated. For good reason, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for political reason.
Well, I got onto this National Geographic site again, which I should have had. And the author of what they've got written here is Marcin Jamkowski. He has written this thing called The Ghost Ship. The Ghost Ship Found, but it's really just about how they found that ship lying down there, and yeah. then they were able to study it and so on. And then after that, there's a section by David Woodell that goes through all the latest research on the numbers and figures of how many people were on these ships. And,
oh, yeah.
And there is a controversy. I don't know if it's a controversy, but there are two different, you know, there's, let's see, the highest number comes from Joachim Wittekind and his work. And, he was a merchant marine officer who was on the Steuben and, as a passenger.
Uh-huh.
And he was helping the ship's officers and estimate the number of people and so on. And he said he counted 5,200, but they reported only 3,600 or so because the German authorities had forbidden such large evacuations.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
According to the German authorities, they weren't able to overload the ship like that. But
right.
they did it anyway because I suppose they felt so sorry for these people. And they had
yeah.
so many of them, and they thought, well, we can put more on here. So that's why they reported less, according to him. And then the well-known historian Heinz Schön, S-C-H-O-E-N, claims he has a smaller total. And his has been there for some time, where he says there were 2,800 wounded soldiers, 800 refugees. He goes through all this and says that there were total of 4,267
uh-huh.
and 3,608 died. But they the consensus now seems to be going toward the Wittekind number for a higher number, not that much higher, but 52,000 over 42,000 people.
Yeah.
1,000 more. That seems to be the favored number because I've seen it. Even on Wikipedia, they were accepting that. So that's their story. So I know that in the Gustloff, which has really been adjusted from, up to now, 6,000, over 6,000 people. And, now this Schön is going the opposite direction on the Gustloff. It used to be 6,000, but he says now that it's 10,500
uh-huh.
On the Gustloff. And,
yeah.
Previously the Goya was considered the number one worst disaster, but now the Gustloff is because of this new research. So, and that 9,343 died and only 1,239 survived. And it,
terrible.
This one is awful because, it took 62 minutes after the torpedo attack for the ship to sink. I think it would be better. And the Goya sunk in 4 minutes. 4 minutes.
Yeah.
Is that the one that sunk in 4 months? Must be. Yeah, 4 minutes. I think it would be better if it sinks real fast, or than if you're worrying about it and slowly going down and you don't have any help for an hour. I wouldn't like that. I can't think of a worse way to die, except maybe in the Dresden bombing, huh? I mean, these are all some terrible, terrible things.
Right.
Yeah, what do you, the Gustloff was just, January 30th, anniversary, and, it is the most well known, and it is the worst ever. And now it's up to, 9,343, mainly women and children died. Now on this boat, it was carrying 8,956 refugees. 9,000 refugees, mainly women and children.
Yeah, yeah.
And most of them died. 9,343 died. So only a few survived, and it took 62 minutes. What a horror that must have been. So there was no, and that was the first one that this Russian submarine captain brought down. I guess he was so proud of himself. He was really up for doing it again and getting another one, which he did. And his story, you know, is that he was considered a drunk, and he was almost court-martialed at one time, but then right before that, I wish he had have been, but they said, well, then they wouldn't have that submarine, that S-13 or whatever, would not have a captain for a long time, and they didn't want to put that submarine out of commission, so they gave him another chance. And I guess to make up for it and to make sure that he, you know, he was going to prove his worth, that he was supposed to prove himself, he went after these refugee ships. And maybe somebody else wouldn't have done it because nobody else was around there, just his submarine.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I guess submarine captains have a lot of leeway, do they, in where they are and where they go. They're way down there under the water. I mean, I don't know how much they're controlled. Do you?
Well, they're given the general directions, you know, what to do. But tactically, I guess it's up to them to choose the right moment to attack. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, you know, after that, but even after that, they didn't give him the Hero of the Soviet Union Award. And it wasn't because they cared about these people on these ships or these refugees or anything. They were happy about that. But it was because they thought he didn't have the character and reputation and so on to be a hero of the Soviet Union. So they gave him some other award. And it wasn't until 1991, I think, and as I was writing a comment about that, under Gorbachev, we figured out it wasn't under Putin. He came a lot later. That he was awarded Hero of the Soviet Union posthumously, this guy. And then they named a street in Leningrad after him. Was it Leningrad? And which is the one used to be St. Petersburg?
Kronstadt?
No, is that used to be St. Petersburg?
That was part of St. Petersburg. That was the military installation.
Yeah, but okay. Well, that's where he is. He's got some things named after him there, and then he's got some little monuments around.
Yeah.
So he's been reinvigorated. And his failings have been forgiven him, and he's now being honored. So
he doesn't deserve it anyway. So
no, and so you know, if we lived in, if it wasn't, you know, when it comes to war crimes, they're not particular at all when they accuse their enemies of war crimes. They accuse the Germans especially, but also the Italians and the Japanese, and they accuse them of war crimes, you know, for any little thing. But when it comes to what the Allies did, nothing is a war crime. And,
this is actually true,
So unless there's something, there's a lot that could be talked about this, you know, the statistics and everything. Oh, yeah, I know what I wanted to say, that I read that Gross Admiral Karl Dönitz, or Great Admiral, the head of the Kriegsmarine, wrote in his memoirs, he said that that in spite of the terrible losses that occurred in these three sinkings, the overall German sea evacuation was a big success. and that these 20,000 deaths, because he didn't know there were that many at the time that he was writing this, because they have been raised up since then. But he said that the deaths on these three ships, painful though they were, represented only 1% of the total brought out by sea. That amazed me.
That's really an amazing feat to do all
really?
That.
Really? 99% of the of the people who were put on ships and boats and so on and carried off, you know, by sea to safer territory, 99% managed to get there. So this was only 1%. I didn't figure that out. If 20,000 is 1%, what would the total be? It would be 200,000 or something, probably.
400,000, yeah.
Yeah. So they did some, and he says the percentage of refugees lost on the overland route was very much higher.
That's right. Because some of them were run down by the Soviet tanks, you know, they just went over them with their tanks.
Yeah. You know, I'm one of these people, though I like water, the idea of going out on a ship seems more dangerous than going on land. And so this did kind of surprise me that was as successful as it was. And that makes me feel better, too, doesn't it, when you think that most of those people did get somewhere safely.
Yeah.
Well, how they did after that, you don't know, but... if you...
Edmund Dönitz was also the last German chancellor and successor to Hitler.
Right. Admiral Dönitz. Well, I just think he was a wonderful man.
Yeah.
He really personified the best of, you know, I mean, best qualities of German people. I can't find, I should read a biography of his or something. I can't find any fault with him. Well, speaking about reading books, I think we'll move on to Dresden so that we can have the second hour free for the, for your paper. And, you know, we all know the story of Dresden, but again, we're dealing with numbers and whether it was a war crime. And the number that I see most reliably put is a minimum of 150,000.
That's
deaths.
Right.
Yeah. Now,
well, certainly much more than that, actually.
Well, that's it. David Irving goes to 300,000.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying it wasn't that. But I'm just saying that to be on solid ground, I think it's pretty well understood that 150,000 is a minimum.
That's right, the minimum.
Yeah.
And then if you go according to Kurt Vonnegut, the American author of Slaughterhouse-Five,
mm-hmm.
he was an American POW in Dresden at the moment when the city was bombed. Who survived, obviously. And he numbered the dead, or in the work of his uncle, at 250,000 men. And all the women, all the children, that means if there really were 250,000 men dead, corpses, in that huge pile in Dresden, there would have been at least 600,000 dead. Including women and children, you know, because there are more women and children than men.
Right. Right. And so, you know, it's not at all impossible to consider that number. I don't know why people act like, oh, it can't be that. Because of all the people that were in Dresden then and the kind of firestorm that was going on.
Right, right.
And not just one, but three times.
Right.
Over beginning, I guess, what does the February 13th stand for? Does that stand for the night of the February 13th or the early morning hours after midnight of February 13th?
I believe it was the night attack, the first attack by the British, yeah.
Yeah, it was a night attack, but I didn't know if it was in the after midnight or before midnight.
Probably before midnight.
Yeah. So then they came back later that night, and then again in the morning. I think it was two missions by the British. One would have been in the early, early 14th. And then later on, after daylight, 14th, the Americans came. When they figured, everybody would come back out and we're looking at what was, survivors and what was going on, then they would come back again. That's another thing that was so sadistic.
Right. And then on top of that, the fighters, the Allied fighters, strafed the refugees that were streaming out of the city, or the ones that were next to the Elbe River. You know, the Elbe River is next to downtown Dresden.
Right.
And the people had sought refuge on the banks of the river, and they were strafed by the fighters.
Yeah, now, that brings up something, but I do want to say that before I say this, that I was in Dresden, and I was so looking forward to it. It was a few years ago. And I was, of course, the weather was bad, and then Obama was there. Was just coming when I was there. I had no idea about that. I didn't know about, And I was told by the woman who ran the lodging that I was in, as I was asking what bus to get to go to downtown Dresden, because it was afternoon, but I still had some time, and I was going to go down there. And she said, it's all going to be closed off. You better hurry up, because tomorrow, tonight they're going to close down the whole inner city, and nobody can get in. She was irritated by it, because she was in the tourist business, I guess. And I was shocked. I said, oh, no, because I only had a couple days there, and I couldn't come back again later or anything. I mean, I had an agenda that I wanted to follow. So I wasn't in the best mood, and it was a little cold and windy and so on. But I was disappointed because I had seen these gorgeous pictures, And it just seemed crowded, and like things were crowded in on one another. And I know that they say that Dresden was all rebuilt, so it's just as good as ever. I know it's not as good as ever. Okay, go ahead.
Because many of the surrounding buildings downtown were not rebuilt as they were before 1944, And so the whole backdrop has changed. Though they did succeed in rebuilding the Frauenkirche, the Our Lady's Church.
Yes.
And a German-American researcher, I believe in biology, one of the fields of medicine. I think it was with the some university in New York, a research university, Rockefeller Research University. He received those famous awards in Oslo.
In Oslo, Nobel Prize?
Nobel Prize, and he received, I believe it was $1 million for it. And he donated those $1 million to the reconstruction of the Ladies' Church in Dresden, so it could be done more quickly, which was very nice of him.
Well, really, and what irritates me is that the British nation donated this thing to sit on top, this little golden ornament.
Yeah.
That's at the very top. I don't know. I don't remember now if it's a little globe thing or a cross or something.
Like a failure, yeah.
Yeah. And then they were all, isn't that so good of them? Oh, that's such reconciliation. Oh, that's so wonderful. I couldn't stand that. That's this German attitude, being so thankful for anybody doing anything at all for you when it was Germany that, you know, had to do all that rebuilding itself.
That's right.
But yes, and then, you know, the church was beautiful. The rebuilt our Church of Our Lady was beautiful. But, you know, I found that right in front of it, I was trying to take a picture of the whole thing, and I could hardly get far enough away from the side that I wanted to take the picture of. I just managed to get it in the frame because they were building this big hotel, one of those well-known named hotel chains, right in front of it. And it was still under construction. There was a lot of construction going on, too, plus Obama, things being all, fenced off and so on. And so it kind of ruined it, you know, but there's fantastic, so much fantastic stuff there, but it's not the same. And I don't care when they talk about how they've rebuilt everything. Individual buildings might look exactly like they did before, pretty much.
Yeah.
But the whole thing doesn't have the same feeling to it.
Right, it doesn't, no.
No.
And another sad thing is that the German politicians at best, they shy away from the topic of Dresden, you know. And many of them, mm-hmm. especially the Social Democrats, but others too, they poo-poo the entire thing, and they want to make it ridiculous, as if only, whatever, a few thousand people had died, and the other 250,000, 300,000, whatever, is just a lie, and they're actually persecuting the people who are trying to insist on the truth.
Sure.
The German
go ahead.
German politicians are doing that. They're persecuting their own people for telling the truth.
Oh, they are. And now I was looking for books, and I, you know, that have some of the latest stuff on that. Well, there's a book, 2005. It was published by Frederick Taylor, published by Harper. So it's a big publisher. And he's supposed to have the latest word on everything. Oh, he's discovered. Listen to this. Blah, blah. How he wrote. He proves unequivocally in this book the very real military threat Dresden posed and how a legacy of propaganda, that means from people, like us, shrouded the truth for 60 years. And Publishers Weekly says that the numbers, according to him and his wonderful book, and he has translated the Goebbels diaries, and so he's supposed to be an expert on Germany. He says the numbers actually killed are approximately 25,000, not up to 250,000 as often cited, and he offers a review of the post-war debate on the morality of the bombing, and he corrects some long-standing misinformation that includes the alleged strafing of civilians by American aircraft. You had brought that up earlier.
Yeah.
Well, so according to this guy, it never happened.
Well, that's all balderdash, you know. He knows that he's lying, so.
Right.
It's unfortunate that that kind of a book is published by Harvard University, you know.
No, Harper.
Oh, Harper. Well, Harper is a well-known publisher.
Right. So, you know, it's mainstream. And this is what they're pushing. Frederick Taylor.
Yeah.
These people, I wonder how they can live with themselves, what they're serving here. But in this, another reviewer book list says the same kind of things. It says that the bombing of Dresden has been interpreted as a perfidious British and American war crime by the last gasps of Nazi propaganda. And That interpretation was continued by the East German communist regime until its collapse in 1989. Well, and then it says, newly opened archives and so on helped him to help this tailor to learn that that the air attacks may have been controversial, or they have been made controversial, that the city was negligible military significance, or that its destruction was without purpose because the war was almost over. But he advances contrary evidence about the mounting of the attack and the cataclysmic firestorm. He takes care to, he just says he advances contrary evidence, and he takes care to keep before readers details about the Nazi rule in Dresden. So somehow they just keep pushing that, oh, these bad Nazis had things going on there, and they were doing this and that. And anyway, this whole country had to be destroyed to get, you know, people free of the Nazis. So,
it's really criminal to say something like that, to come up with those kinds of arguments, you know, really.
Yes. Well, I agree. It's shameful, and but there they are, you know. They're working on that. They're working on having it, as you intimated in your paper. And as maybe I've got this down here somewhere. Oh, man, there's a lot of good stuff here. Okay, well, then we go to David Irving. Now, you know, he's saying the opposite. And they want to demonize him. He wrote the book, The Destruction of Dresden. But here he has on his site.
He was imprisoned in Austria, you know.
Yeah, right. But here he's got on his site, Stars and Stripes from May 5th, 1945, Andres. And there, they had a paper article in there, said air raid on Dresden kills more than 300,000.
Right.
And it's by an American, by the Stars and Stripes staff writer. And it's regular in there, in that Stars and Stripes newspaper coming out of London, saying the Allied air raid on Dresden on February 13, 14 killed 300,000 persons, according to a report by Dresden police to a group of 600 British and French prisoners who were given passes by the Germans to enter the American lines.
Yeah.
And it says 9 British POWs, were working in Dresden during the raid and said the horror and devastation caused by the 14-hour raid over a period of 14 hours was beyond human comprehension unless one could see for himself.
Yeah.
It says there, the police were saying 300,000 died, but that didn't include deaths among the 1 million evacuees from the Breslau area who were trying to escape from the Russians. There were no records on that. Yeah, so they're only counting those who they knew actually lived in the city.
Yeah. But there were hundreds of thousands coming from Silesia and other parts of East Germany and concentrating in Dresden because Dresden had been declared a so-called Lazarettstadt, meaning a city for the wounded and so on, that should not be attacked without military significance.
Well, that's right.
Yeah.
That's why I can believe a 600,000 figure. But if you say something like that, they're just going to make fun of you. And, it's better to stick with 150,000, at least. But really, that's too low. So then this guy quoted, he says, the British sergeant, he said they had to pitchfork shriveled bodies onto trucks and wagons and cart them to shallow graves on the outskirts of the city. But after 2 weeks of work, the job became too much to cope with, and they found other means to gather up the dead. Then they said what they started doing was just throwing flamethrowers into buildings where there are a whole lot of dead people. and burning the whole thing up. And then they closed the whole area up and said, they said here, the whole city is flattened. They were unable to clean up the dead lying beside the roads for several weeks. Now, these are people, eyewitnesses at the time, but somehow we're supposed to believe all these Holocaust survivor eyewitnesses. But you can't believe this sounds very credible. You know, and these people were so burnt up into little black things that, you know, you probably, you know, you wouldn't even know how many there were. You're just going through and shoveling all this stuff into a pile.
You could just determine a certain minimum number, you know, several 10,000 and so on, then another big pile of another several 10,000. But on March 22nd, 1945, the police commissioner, police commandant of Dresden, in his order of the day number 47, said that up till then, but a month after the raid, on March 22nd, they had salvaged 202,040 corpses. 202,040 corpses by March 22nd. So that's a minimum of...
Yes, that's right. Well, we're going on our break now. Thanks for those last figures, Andreas, and ladies and gentlemen, we'll be have 5 minute break and we'll be back. Andreas, don't hang up the phone. Let's make
things good. Kamera, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben und bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Nun ist an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Nimmt im Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht, wir werden bei euch sein. Ich schwöre dir, so wahr ich hier steh, ich trage die Fahne, wohin ich auch geh. Nie werd ich euch verraten, für kein Geld der Welt. Ich kämpfe für dich, ungebrochener Held. Ich kämpfe für dich, unbekannter Held. Doch ich höre deine Stimme, ich gedanke zu mir sprich. Du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben und bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Nun ist an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Nehmt im Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht,
egal was geschieht,
wir werden bei euch sein. Und wer dann auch lügt, euer Namen benutzt, eure Heldentaten durch Geld hier beschmutzt, den trifft das Schwert von unsichtbarer Hand. Ein Totenwächter von Wotan gesandt. Ein Totenwächter im schwarzen Gewand. Doch ich höre eine Stimme, die sanft zu mir spricht. Du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben, bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Zeit, übernimmt unseren Eid, in dem Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen, ihr habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein, egal was geschieht, wir werden bei euch sein. Kamera, du siehst, wir stehen für euch ein, die Kraft, die wir brauchen, wird uns Wotan verleihen, ihr gabt so viel, für dieses Land, es war der Glaube, der euch verband. Es war der Glaube, der euch verband. Doch ich höre deine Stimme, ich sage zu mir sprich. Du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir dir mal es gegeben. Bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Nun ist an der Zeit. Übernehmt unseren Eid. Nimmt im Geiste die Waffen. Ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst. Ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht. Egal was geschieht. Wir werden bei euch sein. Und kehre ich einst an deinen Stein zurück, berichte ich dir von unserem Glück. Dann ist es geschafft und wir sind wieder frei. Dein Grab blüht wieder, darum ging's mir dabei. Dein Grab blüht wieder, denn jetzt sind wir frei. Doch ich höre deine Stimme, die sanft zu mir spricht. Du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben und bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Nun ist an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Nimm dem Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht, egal was geschieht, wir werden bei euch sein. Ich höre eine Stimme, zu mir spricht, du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben, bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Und bis an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Halt. Wir sind Geiste, die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht, wir werden bei euch sein.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager on Saturday afternoon on February 8th, 2014. And my guest today, I'm happy to say, is Dr. Andreas Vesterle, who has had a long teaching career in the university systems in the United States and in Europe, and is an expert on, as far as I'm concerned, on on the Eastern Europe and Germany. Although your expertise is also in Middle Eastern studies, right? But you right. are basically political science,
right?
Yeah. Wait, tell us, and remind me of your degrees that you have, what they're in. They're kind of interesting, a variety.
Pardon?
Tell us what you have your degrees in. They're kind of an interesting variety of subjects.
Some of them are in sociology, political science, history, and urban planning.
Yes. You have, I don't know how much writing you're doing, but you have written something, and it is a letter to Queen Elizabeth of Britain, Queen Elizabeth II, and tell us about why you did this and when you sent it to her and what, if anything, has come of it, and then we'll let you talk about what it contains. I've got a bunch of stuff underlined here that I think is really interesting. So, but I'm going to let you take charge of it.
Some time ago, apparently 2012, the Queen Elizabeth of England, by the way, dedicated a monument to the crews of the Strategic Bomber Command. In other words, what they did was great and heroic, you know, and actually what the Cruiser Bomber Command did was, even though they carried out their orders, of course, was to practice Churchill's and Dr. Lindemann's and Sir Arthur Harris's plan of attacking 131 towns and cities in Germany, and with heavy air raids, and not just in Germany, but also in France, Italy, and other places in Europe, And then, of course, in Japan, it was even worse with General LeMay wreaking havoc in Tokyo and many other places, Kobe and Nagoya and so on. And so that's what I objected to, that she should not have unveiled that document to war crimes and crimes against humanity, because not just hundreds of thousands, but millions of people were killed in Germany, France, and Italy, and other places in Europe by the bomber command, British bomber command of the United Kingdom. And that's...
You have here a total of 1.2 million civilian dead in Europe.
Yes, at least. At least.
But when, by that, you mean mostly Germany, France, and Italy? Or are you including a whole lot of...
There's, of course, also Romania and Hungary, Slovakia, mm-hmm. you know, and Bohemia, Moravia, today's Czech Republic.
Yeah. Yeah, because the Allies were bombing all those places as long as they were fighting with the Germans, right?
That's right, that's right. And I myself was in an air raid by the American Air Corps, Army Air Corps, on Palm Sunday in 1945, as I said. And that one leveled all of the big industry, the heavy industry and so on, in the east end of Prague. And as I said, my father's factory received 7 direct hits, so that was very fascinating to be in the middle of it, you know.
Yeah. Right. So, right. And what did the people think? Now, there you were, Germans living in Prague. Your family had been in Slovakia for a long time. You had had probably some of your family in Prague, and you were living in Prague then, because your father did have this factory. So you had your home outside of Prague somewhere, and then you also spent some time in Prague.
Right. My parents' hometown was in Slovakia, mm-hmm. or still is in Slovakia, right? But when they were born, that entire area belongs to the Kingdom of Hungary, you know, so.
Okay. All right. And then, so what did the people think about the Americans coming and bombing them like that?
Well, they obviously didn't like it. One picture that still remains in my mind, one of the huge factories in the east end of Prague was called Kolbendanek. And Prague is built on various hills, almost like Rome. And one of the hills had urban gardens on them, called Schrebergärten in German. And some people had fled into there.
Oh.
A little gardens for urban dwellers, you know, where you can go out on the weekend and grow your own roses and, and radishes and beans and stuff like that, you know.
Uh-huh.
So they saw that they would not be hit by the air raid, and they ran into that area, and by some mistake or something, an entire bomb carpet went down right there where they had sought refuge. They were at least 400 craters from heavy bombs, 1,000 or 2,000 pound bombs, one right next to the other, and all the people that fled into those areas, they were all killed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, were there a lot of anti-German people in Prague?
Yeah, there were.
Okay.
But this is a historic hatred that some, I won't say all, but some of the Czechs, especially so-called intellectuals, teachers and people like that had against Germany since 1848, the great revolutionary year in Europe at that time. And in 1848, there was a so-called Pan-Slavic conference in Prague. That is, the Slavs belonging to the Austro-Hungarian Empire sent some of their representatives to Prague. And at that time, in 1848, Prague was almost exclusively German, you know, German-speaking. And all the famous buildings in Prague, even today, were built by Germans or by Italian architects and artists. But anyway, so these people had this Slavic, Pan-Slavic Congress in Prague in 1848. And what they wanted to do, their program was to push all the Germans and Hungarians out of Europe along the line from the west end of the Baltic Sea, from Lübeck, the famous city on the Baltic, down to Trieste. And anything east of that line, including Prague, and of course Budapest and Krakow and all those places, Silesia and Pomerania and East Prussia, they should all be either killed or just driven out, you know, Germans and Hungarians. So that entire area will be occupied solely by Slavs and Romanians. The Romanians were forgiven for not being Slavs, because they were East Orthodox. So from that point on, from about 1848 on, things got worse and worse, you know, and it was really very unfortunate.
Okay, when you, did you actually send this letter to Queen Elizabeth, and did
yes,
you
yes,
get a response?
I also sent it to the London Times afterwards, so they must have received it by now.
When did you send it?
A couple of weeks ago.
Okay. Oh, so you still might get something.
Maybe so, yeah.
Well, now, you've been unhappy about, I know you wouldn't have liked that Bomber Command monument from the beginning, even when they were pushing for it. It's been over a period of time, you know. Not everybody thought that was a good idea. But the people who wanted it felt that those pilots were not responsible for what they did, you know, and they were brave and they lost their lives and they should be memorialized along with all the other memorials to British World War II heroes. So they won the day and the monument went up. But what caused you to now finally do this? Were you busy with other things or something? Is that why I hadn't heard from you?
Well, it may all be true that these British pilots and gunners and all that were, to some extent, brave and all that. But as I point out in my in the older letter that I sent to a couple of British newspapers a few months ago, on the German side, the defenders were just as brave as the British, probably even braver, because they were fighting a two-front, or then later on a three-front war in the East against the Soviet Union, and then after 1943 in Italy and Southern Europe, you know, and their resources were very much more strained. They just had a small blanket and they had to pull it either toward their chest or toward their toes, and they couldn't use the large the richness of resources that the United Kingdom depended on, because the United Kingdom was backed by Roosevelt and the United States, you know. So Britain was being kept alive by Roosevelt and the United States, and so was the Soviet Union, by the way. So it would have been much more appropriate to build a huge monument to the German pilots who lost their lives defending their country and also defending France and Italy against the Allied Strategic Bombing Command. Yeah.
Well, but that is not the... I know. I said that in my opening remarks. That is not the story that they want to have.
No, they don't.
They're
since 1914, especially since 1945, the big lie has won the day. And if you believe everything that the Allies put forth, you know, you can might as well buy a broken bridge.
Okay, yep. So that brings us to the second part here. I mean, I think, I don't know if this all is part of the letter, but you sign it, and then there's some more pages, and it starts with page one, so this is a separate thing. I really like this part, because it gives me a lot of information, and you start out with the unveiling of the monument, and you say, you know, some of the things you probably just said. But I'll just jump ahead to what I remember. You said it was especially bad happened after. I'll have to look for it while you're talking. But after 1987. Was that when the Berlin Wall came down and the reuniting of East and West Germany?
Yeah.
You seem to intimate that something's got even worse.
Right.
For Germans after that, would you?
It's exactly true. Yeah.
Yeah.
When this actually was just a partial unification. Because what people call East Germany is actually not East Germany. It's like calling Chicago or St. Louis Eastern United States, you know, or something like that. Kansas City, Eastern United States. Those cities like Leipzig and Dresden and Berlin either belong to Northern Germany or Central Germany. And East Germany is the one that was taken away by the Poles and by the Soviets, then finally in 1991, you know. But anyway, even the very fact that these two small territories got together, the Federal Republic of West Germany and the so-called Democratic Republic of Central Germany, the Soviet zone, got together, ignited the fear of Germany getting stronger industrially and perhaps politically and trying to some extent to influence continental politics, you know, economically or politically. And so in order to prevent that, all the other campaign of lies was put into fourth gear, and everything that's happened since then has been an enslavement of the German people, only to the end of keeping them down on the bottom of the scale and slaving away as serfs, you know, for the British and possibly the Russians and the Americans, and not ever again attaining their freedom. So, in other words, German territories, including Austria, and even to some extent Switzerland, are being kept down politically and economically, so they would never again arise again. You know, that's the nightmare of Germany rising again, as it did after, say, 1871, when it defeated France, or after 1919, the peace so-called Peace of Versailles, and we came up again. Then after 1945, the tremendous rebuilding that started after 1948. And so there's this virulent fear of Germany that's keeping the German people down and robbing them of their freedom.
What do you say? What can you say? But anyway, what do you say to these people who see now with the European Union and there's all this thing, oh, Germany's running the European Union and, you know, they're going to take over. Germany has won after all because they're going to leave the European Union. Everybody has to do what they say. But, you know, I mean, I would say that's not Germany. But what do you say?
Well, it's definitely not happening. It has not happened since, I would say it has not happened since 1919, since the outcome of the First World War. Because at that time, before 1914, Germany was really a very strong power, even over the entire world, including, say, Central America and Latin America, parts of small parts of Africa and the Pacific. And it's the building of Germany at that time before 1914 was so strong economically and industrially and also politically and militarily that it definitely did have a very strong influence in continental politics, but not exclusive, you know. There was always a fight against France, against Tsarist Russia, and of course primarily against the United Kingdom. Mm-hmm. But then after 1933, after Hitler took power, he was in no way able to duplicate the power that Germany had before 1919. Despite all the victories and so on that happened before 1942.
Uh-huh.
And particularly after 1945, there's been no attempt at all to dominate the continent.
No. But they say that through Germany's financial prowess, which is really just the hard work ethic, and the intelligence of Germans in areas that, you know, that become, that are important, that somehow Germany is in control of decision making again in Europe.
Well,
but it's not Germany. I mean, that's it's a puppet of the United States, basically, or.
Yeah,
you know,
that's correct.
New World Order.
Because Uncle Sam is actually lording it over Europe, not just Germany, but even over France, and certainly over Italy and Spain and Portugal and all those other countries, Poland. And now there's a big controversy between various parties in the Ukraine, whether to move closer to Russia or move closer to the European unity and all that. And so all that, of course, is being steered by Uncle Sam, you know.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I think that's been that way for several years now with all of these uprisings in these countries, either in the
right.
down in. Go ahead.
Let me say another thing is that Germany is in the middle of Europe, you know, not just geographically, but also historically and culturally. And the great thing that she's accomplished in the past 10 centuries often came from digested various stimuli that arrived in Germany from the south, like Italy, and the west, say the Gothic Age from France, or through Christendom, you know, coming from the Near East. And the historical and cultural role of Germany really is vital for Europe. If if Europe is supposed to survive culturally. Because to the East, the big cultural factor is Russia. And Russia is Eastern Orthodox. It belongs to the great cultural sphere of the Eastern Orthodox peoples, including the Greeks and, you know, the Armenians and Georgians and many Christian peoples in Arabia and Syria and Palestine. But, of course, the Russians have developed their own powerful Eastern Orthodox culture. On the other hand, in the West, there's mainly France and Britain, and, of course, since 1914 and 1917, the overwhelming presence of the United States, which is contrary to their Russian influence in the East. You have what I called would be the earthy, you know, they are wed to the earth, and the Russian and the Slavic peoples, and to some extent the Hungarians and so on, are strongly wedded to the earth, not just because they used to be agriculture in the past, but their culture is a synthesis of Eastern Orthodox religion and what might be called an earth religion. In the West, on the other hand, especially France and Britain and the United States, is more oriented towards, especially the last, say, 4 or 5 centuries, towards mechanistic, materialistic, and positivistic kind of day-to-day exploitative culture. And this exploitation is, of course, getting worse and worse now under the leadership of the United States. We're threatening the very existence of the entire world, the environment, and our earth, our water, our air, and all that, because we can't seem to stop just plunging on heedlessly, paying more attention to money and to Wall Street and to mechanistic and materialistic factors, in contrast to the old Slavic culture as personified by the Russians. Now, Germany's in the middle, and at the moment it's totally dominated by Wall Street in every way whatsoever, you know, including language. But the for the past 1,200 years or so, Germany's task has been to reconcile those two parts. And it's either one of those two parts, the Slavic, the earth-oriented culture wins, or the Western part, the mechanistic and materialistic and the money-oriented culture. If either one of those wins, then Europe and the entire world are done for.
So you're not saying that you take a side and you side with Russia, or you think Russia is the best way to go. You're saying that it needs a reconciliation. We don't want to go to either of those.
Exactly. That's exactly true. A reconciliation and synthesis. That's right.
Synthesis. Okay.
The best parts of both should be combined if possible.
And do you see, who do you see, or where, or what do you see, or anything as who might be doing this, or working toward this now? Is this idea of synthesis of the two sides?
Well, at the moment, there's nobody, because everybody, in all politicians in Germany, everybody who counts for something in Germany and most of Europe, worships the United States, Uncle Sam, and Wall Street. You know.
Okay.
And that's definitely not the way to go. And also, it's not the way to go to worship the Kremlin or total 100% Slavic earthiness and stuff like that, you know. There has to be a combination between the two. And there definitely was arrived at many times. First of all, in the Middle Ages, in the latter part of the Catholic Ages, and then again under Martin Luther, and then again in the 18th and 19th century with great geniuses like Goethe and Schiller and Mozart and Beethoven and Bach and Handel and all these people, you know. They didn't come on earth just because they happened to be born just some kind of an accident, but there was a purpose behind them. The purpose was to reconcile those two main magnets, the plus and the minus, maybe, in a new kind of synthesis, new kind of reconciliation that's vital for the survival of Europe, and I would say for the survival of the entire world. You know?
Wow. Well, that's really interesting. I don't want to forget something, though, here, so I'm going to change this, go on another direction just a little bit. And, you know, you have such a fantastic grasp of overall, you know, the whole long stretch of history, or a very long stretch of history anyway, in Europe and in the Slavic lands, also geographically. And you just, you know, I've never run into that I, you know, could be and know somebody who's capable of that the way you are. And then you're doing the same thing here in what you've written with the bombing plan of the Allies. And you've done a great job of, at least from my perspective, of starting out with what you're saying, like when Britain started its strategic bombing idea of the, you know, of using planes instead of ships to dominate without having to lose men in battle, in land battles and so on.
Exactly.
And then the United States eventually got onto that too. And that's how they developed their strategic bombers and so on. So would you go through the history of that as you see it and how it led up and what it did in World War II and how Germany couldn't defend itself against that whole plan they had?
Well, I'm following in part claims of the writings of Sir Arthur Harris, so-called Bomber Harris, the one who was, after Churchill and Lindemann, the most instrumental in converting all the German and also French and Italian cities into rubble and ashes. And Sir Arthur says that's what you just said, the British ruling class and the British people in general being used through many centuries of world empire. They didn't want to give it up, of course. And they saw that probably the British Navy was getting weaker in comparison to the American Navy. So what needed to be done to quell and to push down all these new insurrections after 1919, like in the Near East and Afghanistan, all places, is to carry out strategic bombings of civilian targets. And that's what they did. The British started the campaigns of strategic bombing against civilian targets, exclusively civilian targets in Iraq and Afghanistan. Of course, in Afghanistan was a lot less. In 1919 and 1920, and they carried that to perfection. And that kind of mentality then influenced them to develop ever new and more powerful bombers for attacking civilian targets. Well, at first they might have also thought of industrial and civilian targets, but the upshot was that the civilians got the brunt of it. So in 1932, they developed a new wave of heavy bombers, which at that time was two engine bombers, including the Vickers Wellington and some others, all of which were characterized by very long range, and the range, depending, of course, on how many bombs they're carrying, They had a range of up to 2,500, 3,000 miles. That is, and in 1932, if they had gone into mass production at that time, they would have been in position to attack the Soviet Union, for instance. And maybe in 1932, the Soviet Union was the preferred target. But then afterwards, in 1933 and 34 and 35 and so on, they started developing the the strategic bombing command further and further. And then, according to Sir Arthur Harris, in 1934 and in 1936, they started developing huge, excuse me.
Yeah, go ahead and do what you need. You know, also, amongst these early big planes were the Handley Page Hamden and the Whitworth Whitley. And I've come across those, and then, of course, the Wellington is the best known. Which right. Then, though, became outdated. It was too something, too slow or something. I don't know. But anyway.
Right. Then in 1936, they developed the four-engine Lancaster out of the two-engine Manchester. And the Lancaster probably became the most efficient killing machine in Europe, and maybe in the entire Second World War. Even though it was only half the size of a B-29.
Wow, half the size of a B-29. See, I've never had any clear idea about this stuff at all. B-29 is that big.
B-29 was huge.
Oh, okay.
And it had a long range, but the Lancaster had a range of something like 1,200, 1,500 miles. But it could carry bombs of up to, first by 8,000 pounds, then 12,000 pounds, and finally 22,000-pound bomb. Can you imagine a single bomb weighing 22,000 pounds?
Mm-hmm.
And it was got the Grand Slam. And
yeah.
It was still dropped on Germany in 1945. It was really horrendous.
So this is the kind of bomb that takes out a whole city block, or even more than that?
Even more than that, yeah, with 10 metric tons. And, well, of course, there are many other factors that come in. And, Bomber Harris used the first so-called 1,000-plane raid on Cologne in 1942. Before that, there were smaller raids, but they big enough, but then the first huge raid was by 1,000 bombers against Cologne.
Mm-hmm.
And Cologne used to be the most Christian city, or the most powerful Christian city north of Rome. That's something like 400 churches, excuse me, and monasteries and so on, and they all bombed to smithereens.
Yeah, though that's a famous that was a famous raid there. And then tell us also about how the Germans were suppressed because of Versailles Treaty on developing any kind of air force, and they finally had to do it secretly. But even so, they designed these great planes, but they weren't these big bombers or anything. Tell us
right.
about the German planes.
Right. Because of
the Heinkel and
so-called peace conference of Paris in 1919, Versailles, Saint-Germain, Trianon, and so on, these people, especially Germany, was not allowed to build any war planes or any large warships, no submarines, nothing like that. So in all those areas, it was very far behind, even though before 1933, there were some attempts at eluding that, say, through the Netherlands and Finland and so on. When Hitler took power in 1933, even he had to be careful not to advertise his strengthening of Germany militarily, because before that there was practically the zero level. There was nothing there, no warplanes, no submarines, no large warships above 10,000 tons and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So what they decided is to concentrate on the development of smaller, fast, tactical airplanes, not strategic bombing. And they came out with airplanes like the HE-111 and the JU-88, which was particularly good. And, of course, the famous fighter plane, the Messerschmitt 109. Excuse me. But all that, of course, took very much time and money. And they were not ready for a big world war when the war in Europe broke out in 1939, September 1st, 1939, in contrast to the British and the French and the Soviet Union, of course.
But now, somewhere I seem to remember that it said that this strategic bomber plan, which was just a plan yet, started like in 1922 or something like that with the British. And
the British first bombed. Carried out strategic bombing against civilian, purely civilian targets in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah, right. Okay, that's where it was. All right, and then when would you say the United States decided they were going to do the same thing?
Well, roughly also around 1933. The B-17, which was an excellent plane in many ways, it started to be developed in 1933, beginning in 1934. And that was, of course, a huge and powerful four-engine airplane. There was nothing like it anywhere in Germany. And the interesting thing is there was a German general named Weffer, W-E-E-R,
yeah.
And he wanted to develop four-engine strategic bombers to bomb the Soviet industries in the Ural Mountains, in east of the Urals.
Right.
But then he died in an accident, and he was never replaced. And people like Udet, U-D-E-T, who had been to the United States for a long time, and was very much influenced by the idea of the American Navy divers, the diving planes, you know, plunging down from above and taking out Japanese warships, battleships, and so on. And Udet thought that was just great. And he and some of his friends then started developing, instead of big strategic bombers, started developing the dive bomber, especially the JU Junkers 87, which in many ways was very very good.
Yeah, it was very effective. But what I got from what you wrote here was that it was taking out bunkers, bridges, and battle wagons in a fast-moving blitzkrieg, but it wasn't able to destroy whole cities like the strategic bombing was doing.
Not at all.
Yeah. Okay. Let me just say here, because I find this so fascinating, because I hear all the time people criticizing Hitler and the planes and Goering too, but Hitler should have known better, and letting these not building these big bombers and letting these people like Udet do what they wanted. Well, then you, as you say here, this Weffer, W-E-V-E-R, he was the advocate of the strategic bomber. And then he was in a meeting with Hitler and some others, you know, a big meeting. And then when he left the meeting, he was flown somewhere, and the plane crashed.
Right.
And you said that changed everything. And I wonder, do you suspect any kind of foul play there, or was it just you think it's just a pure accident?
Well, Yeah, I just wonder about that. I don't know. I've seen some strange approach in those days. Airplanes were a lot less reliable than that today.
Yes.
And it is possible that it was a rigged accident and that some factions in the army or in the air force in the Luftwaffe tried to get rid of him because it was too much opposed to their plan of developing small tactical airplanes. Mm-hmm. They would develop big strategic airplanes. So they might have got rid of him through an accident, possibly. I'm not sure.
Do you remember if that was a meeting with Hitler that he was in, or was it just a meeting with the other Air Force people that he...
I'm not sure about that one. I think it was just a meeting with other Air Force generals.
Okay. Well, you know, there were other great people who got killed in these plane crashes. And, you know, it's like you say, it was more dangerous then. Now we think, well, how can they not be able to, you know, they're the government, and they've got these great planes and pilots, and how can they be having these crashes and stuff? But it did happen then. I think it's a shame. And I don't know, though, if General Weber had his way, if things would have been any better, though, you know, because they would have not had the other planes. They could only have so many planes. They weren't like the United States.
Yeah, well, the thing is, of course, Germany didn't have the geopolitical factors in its favor the way the USA did, and the huge industrial complex mm-hmm. that the USA did at that time in the 1930s, even though it was in the depth of the Depression. And you had to decide either develop big bombers, strategic bombers on one hand, or develop small tactical airplanes. So they decided to develop small tactical airplanes for a very limited war, not a total war.
So then when did the total war start?
Well, the total war started in 1941 with Pearl Harbor and possibly Hitler's attack on the Soviet Union. But Hitler's attack on the Soviet Union might have been total ideologically, but it was not total militarily because he just didn't have the wherewithal, the power to really bring the Soviet Union down. So the only ones who were equipped to carry out a total war were the United Kingdom and especially the USA. No other powers on Earth were able to do that.
And it was in 1943, January 1943 at Casablanca, that was first talked about, is that right?
At the Casablanca, the conference of Casablanca in North Africa,
mm-hmm.
they had a division of labor between the USA and the United Kingdom.
Oh, that's right.
Which the USA would concentrate on daylight attacks on industrial targets, which actually was more dangerous. And the British would concentrate on wiping out civilian targets, cities and towns. And that's what they did.
Yeah, and so then there you have so the British are the ones who are the big famous ones for killing civilians and having this design, Bomber Harris's plan and design for destroying living quarters of all the working people and so on.
Exactly.
And that is more evil than what the United States is their part in destroying the manufacturing plants and so
that's
on.
That's right. That's correct.
But they didn't mind.
Let me tell you one just a little sidelight here about Winston Churchill, because actually Churchill was the one that, excuse me, was the Supreme Commander in the United Kingdom, and he was responsible really for carrying out this bombing offensive. And there's a book by a French minister, used to be the minister of Interior Minister of France. His name is Dastier, A-S-T-I-E-R, Dastier. In his book, Les Grands, in which he discusses the various great politicians of the Second World War, he said the Churchill showed him around in his war headquarters, and there were stereoscopic sights, you know, where you peer into it, and you can concentrate, and you can look at various photographs. And there's a whole forest of stereoscopic sights mounted on tables. And underneath those sites, there were photographs of destroyed German cities. And Churchill ran up to Monsieur Dastier and pulled him over and told him to look into in there and adjust the sights, you know, the knobs and stuff like that. And each, all those photographs showed were the ruins of Hamburg and Leipzig and Berlin and Cologne and Essen and Düsseldorf and all those places that were bombed to smithereens. And Churchill was so happy that he jumped up and down and he behaved like being at a soccer match, you know, when they're pushing. Yeah, he jumped up and down and howled with glee because he killed so many hundreds of thousands of civilians and wiped out all of these cities.
Gosh. And this guy wrote about this in a book, or he told the story,
book,
or what?
Yeah.
In his book.
The book is called Les Grands, L-E-S-G-R-A-N-D-S. His name is Dastier, D, comma, A-S-T-I-E-R.
Okay. I've got that written down. The other is Le Grand's.
Yeah, Le Grand's, yeah.
Le Grand's, okay.
The Greats.
The Greats, okay. Okay. Well, this, so, of course, you're no fan of Churchill. Not too many people are, but, so what else, what about this thing between Bomber Harris and Churchill? You just said that Churchill is ultimately responsible. And Bomber Harris finally wrote that too, because Churchill was trying to blame him, and he finally made it clear in his book, I guess, that that this was Churchill's plan, and he was carrying it out, and everything had to be approved.
Right.
Basically, I guess. Is that right?
That's right.
But Bomber Harris enjoyed it too.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah.
But he was not the supreme commander. No, Churchill was the supreme commander. And in addition, Churchill's good buddy, Lord Chalwell, or Dr. Lindemann, you know, from Oxford University, who was a supposed scientific advisor of the Prime Minister.
Yeah, talk about Lindemann. I know you really don't like Lindemann either. He is a German Jew who...
Right.
Went to work and went over to Britain, or was he born there by any chance? Or
it's unclear exactly where he was born. He had an international background. Some of his ancestors were German Jews, and others came from America and Britain and so on. So, at the moment, I don't know whether he was born in Britain. I don't think he was, but he was in Britain during the First World War, fighting for the Brits, you know, and so and being at the University of Oxford.
Okay, so he identified as British.
Right.
And a lot of this was his plan too, right?
Right.
What part was his plan? His plan was to bomb the inner cities and the working class people's housing. That was his plan.
Right. He wanted to, he published this in a memorandum to the cabinet, the war cabinet, in 1942, that by 1943, he said, we should be able to develop, to build 10,000 heavy bombers, which would wipe out 58 German cities with a population of 22,000 people, 22 million people would be dehoused.
Yeah. Yeah.
Of course, they don't mention the fact that a large percentage of those, if that plan had really reached fruition, a large percentage of those would have been dead. You know, large, say, whatever, 2, 3, 5 million dead civilians, you know.
Well,
Lindemann and Churchill didn't care about that. They just wanted to strike Germany from the map as a factor in Europe. You know, Churchill had his hatred of Germany dating way back to the age of King Edward VII, you know, and so on.
So then you say, and you've already mentioned it, but you say that the only thing that was even worse than what they did in Germany was what they did to Japan. You think that, and that was just the USA. You think
right.
that Japan suffered more than Germany did?
Right. Japan was even worse because of the building construction. You know, they're small. Residential buildings
mm-hmm.
being built of wood or bamboo or paper and stuff like that, they catch fire very easily.
Right. we've only got a few minutes. All this material be published somewhere or published on the internet? Does somebody have to type it all up and make it available, or what?
I suppose so. You'd have to type it into the internet. Yeah, yeah.
Onto a document. You haven't done that. You haven't had anybody do that?
I haven't done that yet, no.
Yeah, are you planning to do that, though, too?
Yeah, maybe I should do that.
Yeah, I think you should do that. I definitely think this is really good. There's a lot. Well, we covered the high points, but there's a lot of detail here that people
right.
would find very interesting and helpful. So you should do that. I will be asking you if you have. It wouldn't take that long for somebody to type it. Well, we've got 60 seconds. Andreas Vesterle, I'm so glad you were on today. I think it's been fascinating, and hope you will come back again. We'll be talking. Is there any last word you want to give to the listeners?
Thank you very much.
Well, yeah, and you will. I hope you keep well, and because you have and I hope that you can get this published, because you have a lot of knowledge that we, you know, should be passed on, should be put into hard copy form. But you're still waiting to see if you hear anything from the newspapers, or do you think, have you given up on that?
Well, I don't know about the London Times. Let's give them a few more weeks.
Okay.
But I sent the first part of this memorandum to the...
Okay, well, we're going off the
okay.
air, so thanks a lot again, and goodbye,
You're
listeners.
You're very welcome. It's been a pleasure.
All right.
Bye, everyone.
Thanks for listening. And be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.